And this is KBCW. Good morning. It's 8:06 on this Monday, May 11th. I'm Grace Dorfler. I'm filling in for Leslie Thatcher on the local news hour this morning. It is 44 degrees in Park City right now, with a high of 81 this afternoon, 43 and sunny in the Heber Valley with a high of 87. With details about today's weather forecast is ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Monday, KBCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back as we head into a new week. Get ready. We're talking about near record high temperatures as we go into the next couple of days with some big time summer heat moving our way. High temperatures today in the Park City area at a nice, comfortable low 80s, but that's pretty warm if you're going for a hike this afternoon. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, we're looking at those temperatures climbing into the upper 80s to right around 90 degrees for your daytime high. We are expecting lots of sunshine today. The UV index is at 9. That's in the very high category. So you'll need that sunscreen throughout the day if you're outside for long periods of time, or you could burn in less than 20 minutes. So sunscreen, SPF 30 or greater. Otherwise, as we go into your Tuesday, the peak of the heat arrives. So sunshine, high pressure directly overhead. We're looking at high temperatures in Park City climbing into the lower 80s for you. Low to mid 80s actually expected in Park City for your Tuesday afternoon. Meanwhile, the Heber Valley will see those temperatures climbing into the lower 90s. So get ready for a sultry Tuesday afternoon with a lot of heat, but overall, lots of sunshine. Again, don't forget that sunscreen, very important. Otherwise, as we go into your Wednesday, we'll start to track some changes. Those winds will pick up out of the south and west. We'll have gusty winds, dry vegetation. We'll have those hot temperatures around. So that's going to lead to an increased elevated fire danger risk. So be careful. No outside burning expected for us as we go throughout your Wednesday due to those elevated fire concerns. That will be a problem. Otherwise, it's going to stay very warm, but a little cooler than the past couple of days, with highs around 80 in Park City and highs only in the mid 80s over towards the Heber Valley. Once we move into the second half of the week, a low-pressure trough moves through that will keep us dry and quiet with lots of sunshine, a few high clouds, but much cooler temperatures. Highs back in the upper 60s for your Thursday in Park City, with those highs only in the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. We'll stay with highs in the low 70s for us in Park City, with highs in the upper 70s in the Heber Valley for your Thursday and Friday. Heading into the weekend, we'll see those temperatures staying in the 70s for highs, again, with lots of sunshine. That's the latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
A quick preview of this morning's show. First, we will be hearing from Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. He has some updates on viruses in the Wasatch Back. Then Heber City Police Chief Parker Sever will join the show. He shares the latest e-bike laws that went into effect this month and some other public safety updates. And finally, to close the hour, Park City Education Foundation will be joining us here on KBCW to talk about this weekend's upcoming Running with Ed fundraiser and other programs the foundation offers. It's 8:11. You are listening to KBCW. Let's take a look at the local news. A federal judge has tossed a lawsuit that alleged Camas leaders and others conspired to block the incorporation of a new Eastern Summit County town. KBCW's Connor Thomas has the latest on the fight over West Hills.
Backers of West Hills sued its opponents in August of last year, 3 months before the incorporation proposal was to be decided by voters. The claim by a pro-West Hills group called The Preserve was that Camas City leaders and the Camas Valley Preservation Association had launched a coordinated effort to sour locals on the plan. They wanted such efforts stopped and for Camas City to rescind an ordinance opposing West Hills before any ballots were cast. The election was called off, at least for 1 year. And on Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Ted Stewart declined to sanction Camas, KVPA, or any of the named defendants. The judge found the various emails and communications the lawsuit relied on didn't amount to fraud or a pattern of illegal activity. The Preserve was formerly Cascade Capital Group and owns 266 acres between the Camas Gun Club and Toohey, south of State Route 248. It had accused Camas Mayor Matt McCormick and nearby residents Jeremy Bristol, Lindy Sternlight, and Craig Savage of conspiracy. Savage, who lives in Toohey, was happy to hear about the dismissal.
To be honest with you, it was so silly, I totally forgot about it. I knew this would be the result, and I'm thankful that the district court or the federal court saw it that way.
The Preserve had sued under the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO, the 1970 federal law aimed at eliminating the mafia and organized crime. The preserve is owned in part by Sam Castor, an attorney with Las Vegas-based Lex Technica, which drafted the lawsuit. Castor told KPCW in a statement that the preserve, quote, plans to continue litigating. McCormick didn't immediately respond to a request for comment.
They can't go after, public officials and professional people without foundation.
Multiple West Hills supporters are attorneys at firms that have now mobilized against local governments. They believe public officials in Summit County have not been sufficiently neutral on incorporation. A new state lawsuit was filed April 29th by the Salt Lake City firm Kimball Anderson, where the incorporation sponsor, Derek Anderson, is a partner. His colleagues Paul Anderson and William Kimball are fighting for the release of Summit County records that they believe will demonstrate, quote, coordinated opposition, unquote, to West Hills. Those requests have been repeatedly rejected and labeled overly broad. The county has not responded in court. The November 2025 vote on West Hills never happened because 10 landowners opposing the town successfully sued to block it. That lawsuit is still pending, so there's a chance the town goes back on the ballot this year. The parties are awaiting a final decision from the Utah Supreme Court, which heard oral arguments in February. An attorney retained by the Camas Valley Preservation Association and its current and former members, Michael Judd, is a shareholder at Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, which is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, in the studio with me is Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant with some updates. Phil, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with hantavirus, which I don't know if all of our listeners are paying attention to national headlines. Of course, it's making headlines because three people have died after contracting the virus on a cruise ship, and several others have fallen ill. For listeners who might not be as familiar, could you share some basic background of what hantavirus is and how it spreads?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely one of those things that's in the news right now. We learned this morning that 17 Americans that were aboard a cruise ship that started in South America have landed in the United States and are being taken to the National Quarantine Center in Omaha, Nebraska. Where this started is back at the early part of April. A ship that, a luxury cruise ship that was intended to make its way from South America through different parts of Europe and elsewhere, had an individual that was positive for hantavirus, a specific strain of hantavirus. And when they boarded the ship, a few days later, came down with symptoms consistent with hantavirus. And then this variant of hantavirus is the only one that we know is spread person to person. And the cabin mates of that individual contracted hantavirus as well. So it's important to clear up that based on early indications of the investigation that the hantavirus was not actually on the ship when it started, but it was brought on by an individual, a specific strain that is, can be shared person to person. The second case was an adult female who was a close companion of this individual that was case number one. And from there, different exposures inside of the cabins happened to other individuals on the ship. Now, 150 people were exposed. As I said earlier, 17 Americans were on that cruise ship, have now returned to America. Two have tested positive for hantavirus, or this strain of hantavirus. All of which 17 Americans are going to be held in Omaha for further observation to make sure that they do not re-enter back into the population with a potential strain of hantavirus that can be spread person to person. Among those 17 was one Utah resident. So we spent the better part of the weekend on the phone with the state health department. All 13 local health departments are working closely together. We don't know much about the individual Utah case or exposure yet, and if they are positive. However, we are prepared in with the support of the state health department and the CDC as a state to manage this situation as it presents itself.
So the Americans, they'll be quarantining in Nebraska until the incubation period is deemed to be over?
Yeah, they'll undergo a series of tests to make sure that they do not have HANA virus, and then they'll be monitored for, I believe it's 30 days to make sure that they do not develop symptoms. And that's a standard protocol in situations like this. The facility at the University of Nebraska is intended to hold American citizens that have been exposed to a disease such as HANA virus in a very safe unit where they can be treated if they do come down sick, but also it protects the rest of the American population from reintroducing them back into society when they potentially could be spreading disease.
Right. People who have been exposed are not entering directly back into their communities. There's a buffer there.
Absolutely. And that holds absolutely true for the one Utah resident that we know of that was on the ship.
Yeah. As you alluded to, historically, we've seen this virus pass from rodents to humans, and now we're starting to see a human-to-human strain. How worried does that make you as a public health expert?
Yeah, it's anytime we start to see human disease, especially one that's unique like this, it raises an eyebrow. But it's important to know that, as you said, most HANA virus cases come from rodents to human. And it takes a very special and unique situation for the variant that we're discussing, which is referred to as the Andes virus, to go human to human. It requires a lot of close contact. It's usually from household members, intimate partners, or caregivers, and in this case, cabin mates, where there was prolonged exposure, very close contact. So the Andes virus is not new. We've known about it for a little bit of time, and it's been studied. It's unique that it occurred in the way that it did on a cruise ship. However, with the information that's available to us right now, I'm confident that the steps that have been taken are going to limit disease transmission, and we'll keep an eye on it.
Okay. For some listeners, this might be bringing back memories of the early days of 2020. I mean, do health experts think this could turn into more of an epidemic scale situation?
All early indications are no. We can't say with 100% certainty, no, but the life cycle and the way this is currently being transmitted and the actions that were taken by the World Health Organization, Spain and the Spanish government, as well as the CDC, I think that they have a fairly good control of it. What's unique is that the 150 passengers on that cruise ship were not reintroduced back into society without careful consideration. So this was not something that was allowed to rapidly spread. And with it being known, I think the chances of that are really, really low. Not zero, but low. And I would hesitate right now to think that we are entering any sort of pandemic type situation as we saw with COVID under this HANA virus. There are cases where it does pop up here and there throughout the state, throughout the nation, and worldwide annually. And this is an unfortunate situation, but right now, with the information that we have, we're going to keep an eye on it and see if this starts to transition into anything different than what we typically see with HANA virus.
Yeah. Are there any populations who should be cautious? I don't know where people come into contact with rodents otherwise or how else people catch HANA virus, but any advice you're giving in that regard?
Yeah, you can visit our website. The staff just did a wonderful job getting really relevant information up for Summit County residents. But anytime you're in an enclosed space with rodents or rodent droppings, there's always a concern at this elevation. The species that traditionally carry HANA virus we have here in the state of Utah. And so it's really just about taking care of the cleanup, wearing a mask, using a 50-50 bleach to water solution to wet down the area before sweeping or removing the rodent waste, and acknowledging that the risk is there and being careful anytime you're in an enclosed space.
Good to know. Yeah. Well, let's move on to a different infectious disease, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Let's talk measles. Where does Summit County stand with the statewide outbreak right now?
Yeah, we're holding at 5 cases. The state has 638 cases, and we have still been fortunate enough that we have 0 deaths related to measles. This has reached a phase in the response where it's kind of a slow burn. We're gonna see cases here and there across the state. School is just about ready to take a break for the summer, so we would anticipate some of those cases going down across the state. but it's a great time to evaluate vaccination for your kids before we start back into the next school year. You know, with the summertime here, we have the opportunity to revisit the conversation with our school districts, our superintendents, the staff, and make sure that we're doing the best we can to protect our students in the event of an exposure inside of the school. And we would encourage parents to reach out to pediatricians, to their family care physicians, to the health department, school nurses, whoever they feel comfortable and confident in talking to about the power, the safety, the protections offered by the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella. The interesting thing about this measles outbreak has been cases that have popped up in children that were unvaccinated. We've seen a different perspective from the families that went through a measles exposure or a measles sickness, and that there's now a different interest in being vaccinated, seeing that the protection it offers, you know, it's not a fun sickness, it's kind of miserable. And seeing their kids go through that, it's maybe opened their eyes or helped them understand the protections offered and not wanting to go through that themselves or their other children to go through that. So it's been a really powerful thing to have conversations with these families and the experiences they've had, but it also helps us understand some of the hesitations around vaccines so we can speak with a little more compassion, a little more understanding as to why some families are hesitant, answer those questions in a way that helps them understand the protection that it affords and then make the best decision for everybody moving forward.
Could you tell me a little bit more about that? I believe Summit County is not quite at herd immunity for our school age population. What are some of the hesitations? What work needs to be done to reach that threshold?
Yeah, we are not at that 93 to 95% threshold that would be considered herd immunity, but we still have a very high vaccination rate, which is one of the reasons that we've only had 5 cases. The work around that that needs to be done is really about information. And the individuals that we have spoken with did not have the same information that we do. Mm-hmm. Their sources were a little different than ours, and we're able to back it with science and research that has been done over the last 30 years in a way that it's the safest vaccine we know. In fact, it's the vaccine that all other vaccines are measured against for efficacy and safety. Mm. And it is almost 100% effective when the two-dose series is administered. So the conversations that we have are not anything other than just sharing what the science, what the data, and the academic research shows us. And really, that's been a powerful thing for, as I said, for the families as well as us as public health professionals and understanding both sides of the story.
Yeah, makes sense. I do check the dashboard once in a while, the statewide dashboard, and I see that wastewater in Summit County is still testing positive for measles. Does that concern you that there may be cases that aren't reported or aren't going to get tested?
Yeah, I think there's always that little voice that has me wondering where that case is coming from. Is it somebody that passed through Summit County and stopped at a gas station and fueled up or stopped and had food that was asymptomatic? Or is it a resident of Summit County that is experiencing a very mild case or that's vaccinated and is not necessarily experiencing the symptoms that we traditionally associate with measles? So there's always that concern. We've had periods where we've had back-to-back-to-back tests that were positive inside of our wastewater, and then we've had periods where two or three testing cycles showed zero measles in the wastewater. So that's what I referred to earlier as this being a slow burn. We're going to see these cases pop up. We're going to see hills and valleys. We're going to see challenges and things related to measles. And the best way to do that, as you've alluded to, is to consider vaccination and get us up to that number where we can go about our daily business and not have to worry as much about whether or not we've been exposed to measles, because those exposures are happening statewide. It's not just localized anymore.
Yeah. In our last couple of minutes here, Phil, I want to talk briefly about behavioral health. Your team presented a budget for fiscal year 2027. It looks like it'll be a little bit smaller next year. Could you talk a bit about why that is?
Yeah, that's the ebbs and flow of public health funding, and seeing some of the decisions and actions that were taken at the legislative session this year, funding was cut in some areas and increased in other areas. Some of that is based on the data that are available to us, and others are based on the initiatives of what the legislature would like to see. For us, the behavioral health budget and the area plan that accompanies that is an annual event. We go through that to make sure that, one, that we're meeting the state statutes, but for me, most importantly, is that we're meeting the council's goals to provide services, the county council's goals to provide services to Summit County residents related to behavioral and mental health. So the exercise of planning and budgeting carefully, strategically, and intentionally is something that we pride ourselves in and we do regularly. And one of the ways that we can chalk up the success of our behavioral health and mental health services is because of these efforts and exercises that we go through.
Thanks. Anything else you would like to highlight for our listeners?
Yeah, just a few quick seconds. We have our seventh event in the Climate Change and Public Health Speaker Series coming up called Tapping In, How Snowpack Impacts Water Quality and Water Quantity. We have a few spots left to sign up. That event is going to be held May 19th at the new Mountain Regional Water Building. It goes from 6 to 7:30 on the 19th. Doors open at 5:30. We have a list of qualified, highly experienced water professionals that are going to talk about how low snowpack has the ability to impact not only quantity, but quality, which, as you might imagine, is a public health concern. And so I'm excited to learn from these individuals and hope the community will join us.
Awesome. Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, on the phone with me is Heber City Police Chief Parker Sever. Chief, good morning.
Good morning, Grace. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for being here.
Good. Always good to hear from you.
Likewise. Well, I'm looking forward to talking a little bit about law enforcement in the Heber Valley. Could we start with e-bikes?
I'd love to.
Awesome. So a new state law went into effect regulating e-bike use. Could you share an overview of what are the main changes that riders should know about this spring?
Sure. So that law is HB 381. It went into effect on May 6, 2026. Some of it remained somewhat similar, like the classes of e-bikes. So there's three classes. The first class is pedal assist only, and that's up to 20 miles an hour, and no license is required for that. And then there's the class two e-bike, which is throttle assisted up to a maximum of 20 miles per hour, and that's also no license required. And then you have your speed pedal assist. So that one has no throttle, but is capable of going up to 28 miles per hour while pedaling. And that one does require a driver's license or a safety certificate. However, the safety certificates are not going to be in effect until May 6, 2027. I don't believe they've set up those safety courses yet. The main things about it is riders 8 years or under are prohibited from operations on public roads. 8 to 13 have to have direct guardian supervision, and 8 to 15 have to complete that online safety course if they want to operate without supervision, and that's starting once again in May of 2027. Some other key new rules are the helmet law is that anybody under the age of 21 must wear a DOT-approved helmet or CPSC-approved helmet. Devices that are greater than 750 watts or can travel greater than 20 miles per hour are reclassified as an e-motorcycle, and those are going to require license, registration, and insurance. There's fines for tampering with e-bikes, and also now the DUI laws apply to e-bikes.
Okay.
And law enforcement is also now capable of impounding e-bikes from operators as well, similar to like a vehicle.
Interesting.
And typically they would release them like to the parents or something if that's the case.
Okay.
And then sellers are supposed to put those labels and stuff on the bikes that they're selling so everybody knows exactly what they're getting and have that disclosure.
Okay. So those DUIs can apply to e-bikes and e-motorcycles?
Yes.
Okay. How is enforcement going so far? Do you feel like there's a lot of out-of-compliance e-bikers around town?
Well, right now, I mean, the law is new, so there definitely is. And, you know, we live in an area that has mountains and stuff like that, and people want to use those things, and I think it's appropriate for them to use it. But, you know, one thing I've seen in my career is that, unfortunately, younger people sometimes make poor decisions, and you put something very powerful. I mean, some of them, you know, some of the Telarios and things like that, you've just cut one single wire. It's capable of going over 50 miles an hour, and you see them going down the roads, and unfortunately, young kids don't make good decisions. They don't know the rules of the road, and some of them operate recklessly.
Yeah.
And we just, you know, I think the state just doesn't want to see those kids getting hurt. Mm.
So there's a lot here for the younger riders in particular, it seems like.
Yes, yeah, and that's what you're supposed to do with, you know, doing it with adult supervision, and then those safety courses that will kick in and at least, you know, help them to navigate riding their motorcycle safely. You know, during this initial phase, definitely law enforcement, I think, leans more towards education. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we stop somebody, we want them to be educated and, you know, tell them, hey, like, I stopped somebody, it was actually before this went into effect, and I just stopped and talked to them and told them the rules that were coming into effect and things like that, and that they need to make sure they had helmets on and things like that.
Yeah.
And so we were definitely, at least our department, will lean towards education, unless we have somebody who's being very flagrant about it.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. How does this law compare to, I know you were part of the conversations to create e-bike ordinances in Heber City and Wasatch County a year or so ago?
Yes.
Yeah. Is much changing?
Not, on that ordinance-wise, not so much, no. We had already outlawed, like, on some of the multi-use trails and stuff, those e-motorcycles, because they create larger ruts and things of that nature. And so a lot of it is still similar. And we had actually passed a helmet law as well in Heber. So a lot of it was similar in nature.
Okay, so a lot of familiar things for riders in the Heber Valley. Is there a speed limit?
Yes. Not that I know of. I mean, this definitely, if you were... You had a motorcycle endorsement and everything. You were driving down the roads, can be the speed limit of the road. Mm-hmm. Some trails might have something, but I have not seen too many trails with actual speed limits. And for instance, in the Heber City ordinance, it says that riders cannot drive recklessly. Mm-hmm. And so that a lot of that's going to depend on what people that call into the police and also what the police observe when they get there and whether or not they're operating in a safe or a reckless manner.
Right, and I'm sure a lot of it is circumstantial, too. Is the trail crowded? Is it empty? Things like that.
Oh, absolutely. Just similar to even on the roads, right? If it starts snowing, mm-hmm. the speed limit may be 55, but it may not be safe to drive 55.
Understood. Well, thanks for that. Any other e-bike safety reminders as we're heading into the good biking season?
No, just, just be safe. I mean, you should always wear a helmet, especially young kids, and watch your children when they're riding them. And generally, if they're operating in a safe manner, they're not going to have too much problems with law enforcement.
Good to hear. Let's move on to artificial intelligence. I've heard some public interest in how law enforcement is using AI, and I'm curious to hear a little bit about what Heber police officers use AI for.
Yeah, we actually have three programs which have been really beneficial to us. The first one is probably it's the newest one that we have, and it's not really AI, but I think it's similar, is we have a Translate on our body-worn cameras now. And that's provided through the company that provides our body-worn cameras, and it's really slick. So the officer, it can auto-detect up to, I think it's 70 or 90 languages. Wow. And the officer double-taps his body-worn camera, and then he can specify the language or have it auto-detect. And when the person talks to them in, let's just say, Spanish, it just immediately says it back to them in English. And when the officer talks in English, the body-worn camera repeats it back in Spanish. But it's better than, like, Google Translate. Google Translate, I've used that. I was just in Italy, and I used it there, and it wasn't super great. It just didn't pick up all the nuances of the language. And this mm-hmm. does a much better job. Mm-hmm. We have several fluent speakers in our department, and having them listen to it, they're like, yeah, this is like really good.
Yeah.
And so we initially tried it out, and And so we had a trial date. And when the trial date ended, it was literally the same day I got like two emails from officers saying, hey, it's not working.
So it's getting used.
Because they were using it so much on traffic stops. So then we got it fully implemented. And I had about seven officers send us letters just saying what an awesome tool it is and how much they love it. Mm. It's still not perfect as far as for, we still need those native translators for like interviews for crimes and things of that nature that are more sensitive. Mm-hmm. But it really helps on traffic stops and some of those more minor offenses that we encounter on a regular basis.
For your basic, yeah.
Yeah, and then another new one that we have is called Blue Voice. And Blue Voice is a little bit different than, it's an AI platform, but most AI platforms are open source. So it searches, like, and what I mean by that, and I could be saying some of these things wrong, I'm not a tech guy. Basically, when I put something into an AI chat, it searches the entire internet. So I might get stuff like ghost information, stuff that really I'm not after, but it's pulling, since it's pulling from all these different sources, I could be getting some, you know, things on law that were 5 years ago or that are from California or, you know, just different things. You don't really know what you're going to get completely all the time. So this is actually a closed AI platform. So this only searches the information that we put into it. And so for us in Blue Voice, we have the federal law, we have the Utah state code, and it's connects straight to the Utah code, so it doesn't go anywhere else. So it's all up to date. Then we have our Hanford Municipal Code, Heber City Municipal Codes, and then we have gate codes for around the city. We have all the officers' phone numbers. Mm-hmm. We have maps for the schools. And so we can load up whatever we want in there. We have form fillable things where you can just talk and it fills out the form. So I could say, hey, I could just type in or say it and say, what's the elements of a theft? Mm-hmm. And that it would just bring up, it would search Utah code and say, in order to have theft, these are the elements you need to meet. And that's super helpful for officers getting information in a timely and quick manner. Mm-hmm. Because we definitely could search it other ways, but like it's really hard when like our policy manual's, you know, probably almost 4 inches thick. So we have our entire policy manual in there. So I can just ask it, hey, what's the policy on this, and it'll pop up that. It's really, I think, the first time in my career that I've been able to easily search the policy manual, which can be very difficult because you have to know exact keywords. But with AI, it says, hey, you said this, but we think you meant that, and it'll pull up the correct section. So it's pretty helpful.
It saves you some headache.
It has, yeah. It's just, it makes it a lot more user-friendly for the officers.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it was just, it's a little difficult. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of codes and policies and laws for the officers to try to learn. It's impossible for them to know them all. So this allows a method for the officers to get that information so that they can make sound decisions.
Yeah.
And then the one that I think most people are talking about a little bit lately is we do have the AI report writing. Mm-hmm. And that's been really successful as well. Having reviewed some of the reports that are written with the AI, I think the actual report is better than what the officers were writing previously. When officers typically write reports, I mean, we could be down a lot of calls, we can be busy, we can have breaks in service where we're writing a report, then we get a hot call and we have to go out to that. And so the officers will put in what they believe to be the facts of the case. Well, by also utilizing AI, the AI is reviewing body-worn camera, in-car video. It could be surveillance videos that the officer loads in. It can be all sorts of different information, and it watches that and views it, and it gives the officer a starting point for that report.
Okay.
And then the officer, and so it doesn't care about time because it's just doing it. You know, it's able to analyze it much faster than we can. So it'll put all that information in, and then the officer goes back and reviews that report. And because you, for instance, like body-worn camera, an officer cannot see everything that the camera sees. Mm-hmm. I mean, they could have tunnel vision, they could be stressed, they could be looking kind of a different direction than the camera, and they might pick up different things. So the officer goes in and adjusts his report to reflect what he actually saw or did, if it's a little bit different than what the AI is reporting. And of course, at the bottom of all these reports, we have put in there that it is AI generated and reviewed by the officer for accuracy.
Yeah, so there's a layer of human.
Yes, and so like an officer, I mean, just I'm not the fastest typist, especially after I cut off my two fingers. Now I'm down to really eight good fingers that I can type with. Mm-hmm. And this allows most of that report to be written. And so a report that could take an hour before, an officer can get done in about 10 minutes.
Wow.
So it's really, I think, a force multiplier for to getting our officers out of the office and onto the street.
Yeah. In our last minute or so here, I'm curious to hear about how you ensure that potentially sensitive data remains secure as you're using these AI tools.
So every tool that we have is USCGIS compliant for security purposes. So it meets all the federal and state standards that are required to ensure that that the information that the officer uses is put into a secure environment. And so the AI report writing itself is a USCGIS compliant report and pulls from our body worn cameras.
And what's USCGIS for our listeners?
Oh, basically, it's the security requirements that law enforcement maintains in its secure databases.
Okay, that's a new acronym.
Acronym. I'd probably have to look it up. Like I said, I'm not too much of a techie guy. I love tech, but there's so many acronyms nowadays. I can't remember them all.
Fair enough.
As soon as somebody said it, I'd remember.
Yes. Yeah, well, thank you for sharing a little bit about those initiatives. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know before I let you go?
No, we love our community that we serve, and please come and meet us in Heber City and wave to us when you see us.
Awesome. Heber Police Chief Parker Sever, thank you so much.
Thanks, Grace.
Well, in the studio with me are representatives from the Park City Education Foundation, President and CEO Ingrid Whitley, and Vice President of Advancement Jen Billow. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Grace.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Ingrid, I'd like to start with you. We're wrapping up another school year. I am curious to hear what are the foundation's biggest accomplishments as you look back on the past nine-ish months?
Well, there's so much to celebrate. And of course, you know, they're not accomplishments we can claim alone. They're through the school district and our amazing educators and students. But just a couple of things to highlight. We were recently named the number two public high school in the state, which is incredible. Amazing kudos to the team there. We celebrated our Excellent Educator Awards last month, and I always like to shout out the winners, give them a little airtime. So Mary Perzicki from Park City High School, Zach Giddings from Ecker, Jennifer Riggs at Jeremy, Sam Thompson at McPolin, Avery Kidd at Parley's, and Lori Drivdahl at Trailside. And then Deb Alcox won our Sarah and Stephen Doyle-Nee Award that seniors bestow upon an educator every year. So just want to shout those amazing educators out. It's always a fun day to go around each school and celebrate them. And there's a lot more. So amazing senior accomplishments this year. The Park City High School class is incredible and going to some of the best universities across the country. But I specifically want to call out our first-gen seniors this year. So we have 53 first-gen high school seniors going on to college or university next year. And just a few of the 20 colleges and universities they're attending include Harvard, Stanford, the U, UVU, Weber State, Westminster, among many others. And so we just want to celebrate their incredible success as part of the Bright Futures program at the high school with the leadership of Pepper Elliott there this year. So amazing support that we have in place for students, and we're just so thrilled to be able to fund and support that program still. Yeah.
That's great to hear, and I imagine it's probably bittersweet every spring to bid farewell to another class of seniors.
Yeah, it is, and I think, you know, it's just amazing to see them go on and do things that are fulfilling in their lives, right, to fulfill their potential, which is part of our mission, so we're really thrilled to be a big part of that.
Yeah. The countdown is on to one of the foundation's biggest events of the year, Running with Ed, of course. Jen, could you share when and where this year's event is? Is it too late to sign up?
No, actually, it is not too late to sign up. We learned long ago that we have to leave it open, because otherwise we'll just keep opening it up when dozens of people say, oh, it's this Saturday, I want to run. So it is this Saturday, May 16th. Registration is still open. It's an 8-leg relay race. So typically teams are 8 people, but you don't have to. You can reach out to us to be put on a team, or you can just run one leg. The last leg from Trailside to Basin Rec is about a 5K, so it's pretty easy. It's all downhill, which is nice. And then you run straight into the finish party, where there's, you know, beer and food and bounce houses for the kids and award ceremony. So it is a great time. Of course, costumes. It wouldn't be an event in Park City without costumes, right? The weather is looking amazing. I almost don't want to jinx it, because it's often called raining with it. It's even been snowing with it. But I think this year
we're safe.
We're going to have a beautiful day. The trails will be in great shape. And we really encourage everyone to come out and just run a leg and take part. It's been voted Park City's favorite fundraiser for numerous years, and the reason why, it's just this amazing community celebration for our public schools, and Park City really comes around our public schools. And the point is to raise funds for all these programs that hopefully help in seniors, you know, getting into the colleges or post-secondary of their dreams. Running with Ed will raise about $250,000. Registration is still open, and the other part that's really big this week is fundraising. So every person who registers also gets a fundraising page. You don't have to fundraise, but we hope you do. Very exciting this year. Over 200 Park City School District teachers and employees are running. Thanks to View Christie's Real Estate, they cover those costs, so they get to run for free. And they all have fundraising pages. So, you know, if you go to runningwithed.com, type in your kid's teacher's name, I bet they'll be running, and, you know, throw a few bucks to their fundraising page. They can earn prizes as well for fundraising. So that's a great way that you can support if you can't run or you're not here on race day. And again, you can go to runningwithed.com to do that.
Awesome. And runners will encounter like kind of little parties at each mm-hmm. of the schools at the district. Does each school come up with their own theme? How does that work?
Yes. Oh, that is the most fun part of the race. So yes, as you run each leg and you go school to school around Park City, and each school does their own theme. I know Trailside, for instance, is doing an El Encanto theme. So I think it's going to be very colorful. Lots of flowers. I've heard there's a petting zoo. There's nothing healthy about, usually there's chocolate and candy and fun things to have at each exchange. So it's just a great party. And the school spirit really shines through. So we hear comments from people that run it, that even if your kid isn't in the school district, they're like, it's just so great to get the personality of that school. And then, of course, we do have an exchange up at the UOP. So that's sort of an iconic leg where you're running up to the UOP. That is not for the faint of heart. And then from there, you can run up the stairs, the 700 stairs, also not for the faint of heart. But you could take the chairlift if you'd rather. But Skull Candy is putting on that exchange this year. So that's going to be really fun. I've been seeing the emails go back and forth. They're going to have a great, you know, great music as per usual. And then we're back to running from Parley's Park to up to Peace Park City Mountain, first time lot. And Momentous is going to be running that exchange. And they're another great local business that'll be doing that. Of course, KPCW has a team in the race, as a wonderful sponsor. So at each place while you're waiting for your runner to come in, it's a great party and a great time. And then it culminates in this amazing party at the Basin Rec Fieldhouse, where, you know, you get lunch, drinks, food, all kinds of kids' activities. Another way to support if you can't run is to just come to the finish party. So it's just $10 for a great meal and drinks, and or $25 per family.
Yeah. Lots to look forward to this weekend.
Lots to look forward to. So we definitely encourage more runners. We have room for more. And again, supporting your favorite family, teacher, person with some fundraising donations.
Cool. And Greg, could you share a little bit about what the money goes towards?
Yeah, of course. It goes to programs across our district that support students all the way from preschool through beyond high school. We have four different ways we make grants, somewhat new this year to us. A couple of legacy granting mechanisms, our express grants and our classroom grants, go directly to classrooms. So teachers request support from us. We have a grant committee that reviews, and our board ultimately approves funding. But a couple of examples of those this year. So we had an aquaponics project that was requested, and actually the students that ran that project won first place recently at the State Technology Student Association competition, which is really exciting. They get to go to nationals now. Our classroom grants, and one that was really recent that was so fun to see, was Finding Nemo. That was put on by Jenna Schmidt from McPullen. Just of honestly, like, heartwarming, tear-jerking musical mm-hmm. for a lot of the audience, and the students did an amazing job. And then we have two new granting mechanisms. One is called our Innovation Grant, and that's for kind of a system-wide or a multi-school new idea that a school district administrator or principal wants to try, and we're here to provide funding for that. So something that we'll be supporting next year is a licensed clinical social worker position in our elementary schools. Historically, those positions have been split among the four elementary schools. At every elementary school next year, there'll be an LCSW position in-house, which is really unique, actually, and exciting for our elementary school kiddos. And then our sustaining grants are kind of our legacy grants that we provide long-term support for, things like our after-school program that are really critical, especially for working families in the district, and we want to continue that funding.
Good to hear. And looking ahead to the summer, I know that educators' work doesn't end when class lets out for the summer.
So true, yeah.
So I'm curious what kind of work goes on behind the scenes at the foundation and in the district to get ready for the upcoming school year.
Yeah, it's a great question. We partner really closely with the school district, so we're already talking about next year. Recently, I had a conversation with the superintendent about what's on her mind and her vision for what we could be supporting next year that maybe is new and different and will really move the needle on the initiatives the school district's working toward. We do a lot of planning for how we raise funds, right? Like, that's our main thing, is to fund and support educator-powered initiatives. And so we do a lot of behind-the-scenes planning on how we kick off the school year with our Build the Foundation campaign, our fundraising events like the gala in the fall this year, November 14th, save the date. And we're always thinking about how we can bring more philanthropy into our schools to benefit our educators and our students.
Good to know. Jen, anything you would add to that?
No, it just does. The summer is a time of planning for sure. So there really is no rest when you're trying to fund great programs for great teachers in Utah.
Yeah. Well, a lot going on with the foundation, as always. A reminder that this Saturday is Running with Ed. Anything else that you two would like to share with our listeners this morning?
I just want to thank the community again for the tremendous support, you know, throughout the year. And if everyone can dig deep and support one last time this school year for Running with Ed, we would very much appreciate it. And it pays off in what we can fund next year.
Sounds good.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. Ingrid Whitley and Jen Billow, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks,
thank
Grace.
You, Grace.
The Salt Lake City International Airport is warning drivers to plan ahead for delays getting to and from the hub starting today. Crews are repaving Terminal Drive, which will cause delays exiting the airport and likely affect passenger pickup and drop-off as well. The project will be completed in phases this month, with two lanes open to traffic at all times. Terminal Drive is the only road that leaves the airport terminal building and parking lots. Roadwork will also affect car rental customers and those parking in the garage and economy parking lots. However, the Utah Transit Authority's tracks trains will not be impacted. Airport officials suggest travelers take public transit to avoid delays.